All right, well, joining me on the line is Gonzalo Lira. He is an American novelist and a filmmaker living in Chile. Starting in 2010, Gonzalo began writing economic analysis for websites such as Zero Hedge, Seeking Alpha, and Business Insider. Gonzalo, great to have you here with us on Follow the Money Weekly.
It's a pleasure being on your show. Thank you for having me.
Well, you really kind of made quite an impact, kind of splash, last year with your writings on hyperinflation, which I want to get into here in just a minute because it really is the buzzword as we head into 2011. People are wondering what's going to happen with all of the quantitative easing and all of the fiscal policy and, of course, monetary policy. But before we do that, I'd like for you just to take a few minutes, just kind of share with our audience your background. You have an interesting background. Talk about where you're from, your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up all over the place in the U.S., Los Angeles, New York, South Florida, and also in Latin America, and spent a lot of time in Europe. I basically did college in the States at Dartmouth, and I worked a bit in publishing. I published a few novels, and then in filmmaking. And you know, now I've sort of like I'm doing economic analysis because it really started as a lark. Because you know, I would annoy all my friends with all my rants about different things, about you know, how the economy was going and what the people in positions of authority were doing, and you know, it's just really to stop boring my friends and my girlfriend, I started, you know, writing economic analysis on a blog, you know, on that the typical blogger blog site. And, you know, I would get about 40 page views per day and nobody was paying any attention to me whatsoever. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, you know, I have this huge audience. And, you know, it's a pleasure and a privilege to have such a large audience. Mostly because the audience I have is really smart, because you can tell by the comments and both the ones that are publicly printed on the blog site as well as the emails that I get. And there are people who are very concerned about the current situation in the economy. And so I feel very fortunate that I've been able to help them out to understand the current situation we're living in. Now, on the issue of hyperinflation, I wrote about that in late August, and the title of the piece is rather famously, you know, how hyperinflation will happen. And when I wrote it, a lot of people said that I was a fool and that was probably, you know, some crazed loon high on drugs or something like that, you know, or worse, I was from California. And, you know, people just didn't take my position seriously at the time. This was late October of last year. But as commodity prices continue to rise, you know, to the stratosphere, and not just precious metals, not just oil, but also, and much more importantly, agriculturals and industrial metals, you know, people started realizing that the possibility of hyperinflation was very real. And the my claim to fame, as it were, in that particular aspect was I showed the theoretical framework by which higher commodity prices and a loss of faith in the treasury bond market could eventually lead to hyperinflation in the United States.
Well, Gonzalo, let's go ahead and get into that. Let's actually talk about that. The piece you're talking about, how hyperinflation will happen.
Sure.
You know, there's no doubt, as I mentioned before, that hyperinflation has been one of those feared buzzwords of as we head into this new year. Just a lot of uncertainty still in the market here in the United States. And if you would, as you did so well in the article, for our audience, take a few minutes. Talk about what hyperinflation is and lay out the scenario or a scenario for our audience of what it would look like if it struck America.
Sure. Hyperinflation is basically a rise in consumer prices. Okay. That's, you know, that's one of the various definitions of it. Now, of course, there are different asset classes and different goods and services that rise and fall in prices in any mature economy, such as the United States economy or such as Europe's economy. Now, we have experienced over the last couple of decades, you know, a severe price inflation insofar as real estate assets are concerned, and also to a lesser extent, equities. You know, I mean, we saw that, you know, in houses that, you know, in 1990 cost, you know, say $200,000 by, you know, the height of the market in 2005, they cost $1,200,000. You know, I mean, absurd, you know, inflation in real estate assets. Now, what I was talking about in my piece was, you know, price inflation insofar as goods and services and consumer goods and services was concerned. And I explained how commodities, the rise in commodities would happen if there was a loss of faith in the treasury bond market. Now, the treasury bond market, for people who don't, you know that much about it, basically, you know, the United States government, in order to finance itself, it issues debt. Now, this debt is called a bond. Now, the United States government goes out and sells these bonds to investors. Investors give the government money, and the government uses that money to pay for its expenses. So essentially, a bond is an IOU. Now, you have to keep in mind, a treasury bond is an unsecured loan, okay? Just like a credit card, you know, nothing is backing it. It's not like a mortgage loan, for instance, or a car loan. If you don't pay your car loan, they come and repossess your car. You know, that's a secured loan. But with treasury bonds are floating on nothing but the good faith and credit of the United States government. Now, if people come to the conclusion that those bonds are not going to be paid in full, then they start to worry about it and they try to sell it. They try to sell it so that it becomes some other person's problem and not theirs. Now, I postulated, what happens if there is a panic in treasury bonds? Now, this is perfectly reasonable, and we saw it just now in December when there was a panic in Irish sovereign bonds. Irish sovereign bonds are the same thing as U.S. Treasury bonds, only they're, of course, Irish and in euros, but it's essentially the same thing. What happened in Ireland this past November, December, was that Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, said a few things that weren't very clever, you know, a few comments basically the effect that, Irish bondholders might have to take a haircut, might have to take a bit of a loss on their holdings in Irish treasury bond, Irish sovereign bonds. And this sent the market into a panic. And in less than 2 weeks, you know, Irish spreads, bond spreads, I mean, the difference in yields between what, you know, Ireland is giving and what other safer bonds is giving, you know, duplicated, you know, at I forget what the exact yields were at the time. You know, it's slipped my mind right now. But the point is, there was a panic in Irish debt, in Irish bonds. And what happened was that because of this panic, Ireland could no longer go out into the market and sell bonds in order to finance its economy, finance its expenditures, the government. And so what happened was that Ireland had to go and get a bailout from the European Union and the European Central Bank and the IMF that worked in concert through the European Financial Stability Facility. That's not important. That's a detail. The important point that that has to be understood as I bring up this Irish example is that in very short order, the panic in Irish sovereign bonds led to essentially Ireland becoming not bankrupt, but being unable to meet its current obligations because it could not borrow money. Now, the United States government has been on a spending binge since the end of World War II. The United States has spent an enormous amount of money, the U.S. government, I mean. And since 1975, the United States has not presented a balanced budget. And all this debt has just accumulated, and now we're paying the cost. And we're at the position where the U.S. debt, between what it owes and the Social Security liabilities, the near-term Social Security liabilities, the United States owes over 100% of GDP. U.S. GDP is about $14 trillion. You know, total U.S. debt is roughly $14 trillion, between $8 trillion in treasury bonds and approximately $6 trillion that the U.S. Treasury has borrowed from Social Security and, you know, needs to have funded. These are all very rough numbers, but the upshot is clear. The United States owes 100% of GDP, and the U.S. federal government is going into further debt every year of about 10% of GDP. Now, you know, every year, the U.S. government is going to add on between $1.2 and $1.4 trillion between now and at least 2014. Now, that means that basically the United States is Greece, financially speaking. And Greece is a basket case. And everybody agrees that Greece is a basket case. Greece owes 100% of its GDP and has, you know, a further deficit of roughly 10% of its GDP every year. So the only difference between the U.S. and Greece is more zeros and more nuclear weapons. I mean, that's really the only difference. So I postulated that if this is the situation in the United States, and nobody seriously disagrees in terms of the direness of the U.S. financial situation, it is inevitable that the United States will have to will either suffer a panic in its treasury bond market or be simply unable to pay because there's nobody left to borrow from. And, you know, you're going to start in basically a money printing scheme. Now, I explained how a panic in the treasury bond market would lead to a rise in commodity prices. And the thing that at the time I thought was the case was that it would be a sudden panic, that everybody would all of a sudden sort of like wake up and smell the nightmare and rush to commodities. But that hasn't been the case. What I wrote about in August has been happening, but it's sort of been happening in slow motion, you know, because you have had this slow and steady rise in all commodity classes, as I said, precious metals, industrials, agricultural, oil. But it's been a slow process, you know. And it's a little bit like boiling a frog. You know, if you put a pot of hot water and have that water boiling and you toss in a frog, the frog will jump right out. But if you put the frog in cold water and start heating that water, the water will boil and the frog will never jump out of that pot, you know. And so it's been a little bit like that insofar as, you know, rises in commodity prices. Now, why is commodity price rise important? Well, because when commodities rise, that rise in price eventually hits the consumer. I mean, it's, you know, if a bushel of wheat goes up, say, 30%, you know, your bread is going to cost 30% more at some point in the near future, okay? Now, a lot of manufacturers, a lot of people who use commodities for their products, the problem, of course, is that as commodities rise, they eventually reach the consumer. Now, consumers are going to start feeling, you know, the rise in prices of foodstuffs, of gasoline, heating oil, most especially this winter. And in point of fact, people are already seeing this. Now, there are two ways that people are seeing that are going to see this rise in commodity prices. Number one, something that I saw Diane Sawyer reporting on ABC, so this isn't, you know, a big secret. The size of the products being sold are smaller. Now, you see this in trivial things. Like, for instance, and on Zero Hedge, there was a famous case of a jar of coffee that before it was 39 ounces, and then a few weeks later it was 33.9 ounces, and yet it was being sold at the same price. And, you know, so there you had something like a 20% increase in price, but it wasn't that the product went up in price, it was that they were selling you less of the product, which is the same thing, net. I mean, it's inflation. Now, people are seeing more and more inflation, and they're seeing it in their shopping cart, in their weekly grocery you buy. And, you know, what does this mean? Well, you know, 50% of the U.S. population spends more than 50% on food and energy and housing. And so housing is steady or even declining, but food and energy are rising. And so what happens is that as prices start to rise, you know, people start devoting more of their income to that particular necessity, be it food, be it fuel, and devoting less to other things. And so you have a slowdown of the economy. Basically, you have stagflation, what happened in the late 70s. Now, what happened in the late 70s is something that we should be paying very close attention to, because in the late 70s you had an oil shock because of the revolution in Iran that made the prices of oil go up drastically. And this eventually reached the pump, and it eventually reached the consumer price index. And the consumer price index started to rise very steadily until March of 1980. From January of 79 to March of 1980, consumer price index rose over 10%, I believe, and it would have continued going on nonstop if Paul Volcker hadn't, raise interest rates in order to halt inflation. Now, he raised interest rates, and I'm sure that a lot of your listeners remember this, he raised them about 5 to 7 percentage points above the inflation rate, the monthly inflation rate. And I've written about this rather extensively. Now, why did he do it? It was basically shock and awe on an economic front before they had invented the phrase shock and awe. But the point was Paul Volcker realized that he couldn't incrementally raise rates to halt inflation. He had to give it a real good kick in the pants. And that's what he did, because he could, because the United States economy was much more robust in 1979, 1980 than it is today. Today, the economy is extraordinarily fragile. You have U3 unemployment of 10%, U6 unemployment of 17%. And if you look at John Williams' shadow stats, which are very well researched, you know, potentially the unemployment is a lot higher, but be that as it may, just the official figures are enough to scare you. And the problem is that the Federal Reserve cannot raise interest rates, because if it were to raise interest rates, the U.S. federal government would be broke overnight, because the United States federal government is broke. It's floating on nothing but air at this point. I've written about the fact that the Federal Reserve for fiscal year 2011 is basically going to print, make up out of thin air, roughly half of the deficit, and is going to purchase an additional 10 to 20% of the debt through what's known as QE Lite. These are details that are not really relevant to the point that I'm trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make is, if and when inflation starts to really rise, the Federal Reserve will not be able to do anything about it, because the economy is too fragile to take a big hit in interest rates. And so what happens with inflation is that once it reaches a tipping point, and you can argue what that tipping point is. I personally think it's around 15%. Other people might argue 20%. It doesn't really matter. Once it reaches a certain tipping point, then it just becomes a self-fulfilling spiral. And we've seen this historically in every country that has suffered hyperinflation. And I'm not talking about obscure, you know, African nations or even not so obscure African nations like Zimbabwe. I'm talking about relatively healthy economies like Great Britain in the 70s, like Germany in the 1920s. In Chile, where I live today, this happened in the early 70s. All of these episodes of hyperinflation happened for different reasons. But the point is that once hyperinflation started really going and the central bank was unable or unwilling to halt it for whatever reason, it quickly spiraled out of control and wound up breaking the economy. Now, this looks like it's going to happen in the United States. And I wrote about how it could happen. And a lot of people at the time that I wrote about it said, oh, you're just, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And now, as it's becoming increasingly clear that inflation is hitting the United States, because nobody can seriously say that prices in the United States have not been rising over the last 6 months, because they have been rising. Well, you know, this is going to be a very interesting winter and a very, very interesting spring, where I expect the official CPI number to start reaching up to 4 to 5%. And I think that realistically, you know, the CPI ought to be hitting, you know, between 7 and 8.5% by the 4th of July. And by the end of the year, I think it'll start scraping the double digits. And once that happens, I think that 2012 is going to be a very nasty year. But hey, you know, I could be wrong, but you know, this is what I think, and this is why I think it.
Well, a very good analysis of hyperinflation, I think, and we're kind of running out of time, and I'm going to have you back on the program, because I want to get to some other topics, including the euro. You have an interesting take on the euro. I'd like to talk to you about that as well. You know, you live in Chile. Just go ahead and incense some of our listeners by telling us what the weather is like down there right now.
Oh, it's sunny and beautiful. I'm sitting in my apartment, and it's just a delightful early summer day. And on the weekend, I'm going to go to the beach. It's great living here. You know, Chile is a really interesting case, because Chile had a number of different kinds of economic shocks in the early 70s and the early 80s for very complicated reasons that, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you can look it up in the Wikipedia or whatever, you know. The point is, because of these various economic shocks and crises and what have you, Over the last, I'd say, 25 years, the economic situation in Chile has been very, very good because everybody in positions of authority grew up and understood how terrible, you know, economic crises could be. And so the leadership class in this country is very united, be they of the far left or the far right, in maintaining a prudent balance of trade, a prudent balance of payments. You know, the government here does not run a deficit. On the contrary, they run a huge surplus. And even the hard left governments that have been in power here are very careful with that huge surplus, and they only spend it on things that are really, really necessary. Right now, Chile has a fiscal surplus of 10% of GDP, very prudently and cautiously invested. I mean, it's basically a nest egg. And so when we had our 8.8 earthquake, some of the money of that nest egg was used, but it wasn't, you know, a big splurge. It was very carefully used. And it's a nation that understands that you have to, you know, plan ahead, and you have to be conservative with your resources, because those resources are precious, and you know, you can't just splurge on them just because of a passing political fancy. And that's why, you know, Chile enjoys the consistent growth that it has, the consistently low unemployment, and the consistently stable economic, macroeconomic situation. Because like in every country, you know, the politicians go on the tube and they complain and they accuse each other of all sorts of nonsense. But, you know, that's a bit of political theater, because when it comes to the really important things about the fiscal situation, everybody, and I mean everybody here in Chile, is very much on the same page of just being very cautious, you know, and very, you know, smart about the use of resources, both public and private. And for instance, in Chile, we have a mandatory healthcare system that actually works. Okay, it's you have to pay for it, and you know, the government chips in a little bit, and it works very well. There's also a private pension fund system that I've written extensively about in my blogspot, called AFP, which is basically a private retirement account, which is mandatory. Every citizen has to have it. And so what's wonderful about the system is it's not that the government holds your money, you hold your money, okay? And it's a retirement account that you can move from a different AFP company, because the AFP companies invest the funds for you. And they compete with one another by trying to, you know, get the best yields for these funds. But the fund is yours, the money is yours, and it's your account. And if you decide that, you know, one AFP company isn't doing the job, you can just switch over and move your account to another one, which gives you a higher yield, or you know, works to that effect. So what happens is that you have removed the government from controlling your money, you know, so that becomes a non-issue in terms of, you know, politicians being tempted to use pension fund monies to fund all sorts of ridiculousness. Now, you as a person feel personally connected to the economy, because these retirement account monies, they have to be invested in Chilean companies. And so because of that, you have the entire population that is personally invested in the well-being of the economy. This was a policy implemented by the dictator Augusto Pinochet. And it's one of the reasons that Pinochet is a very complicated figure, because you can't say that he was just a crazed banana republic dictator. He implemented this system. He personally, in terms of coming up with the idea, it was a very smart economist from the University of Chicago called Jose Piñera, who was a Chilean. But he gave the go-ahead, and he implemented this system, which has been in place for the last 30 years. And it's so important to the economy, because every Chilean feels connected to the economy, because every month they get a statement saying how their personal retirement account did and how much money they have, you know, that's theirs. Okay. And so when, you know, the stock market dips, I mean, people in Chile almost pay as much attention to the stock market as to the football scores. Now, that's not normal. You know, most people in the rest of the world, they care much more about, you know, Lindsay Lohan and the, you know, the Kardashian sisters and, you know, the baseball scores.
You know, Gonzalo, what would be really good here in America would be if they would actually mail out statements talking about how much of our share of the national debt is each and every month. Wouldn't that be nice here in America?
Yes. Yes. That would be much better. Yeah. Because then people would know, of course, that they owe more than they can pay. You know, I mean, that's the sad fact of the matter. I mean, if you think about it, what's the federal budget deficit? I say it was $14 trillion, and there are 300 million people in the United States, roughly. You know, I don't know if you have a calculator there. That's, you know, 14 million divided by 300. I'm trying to do this in my mind. That's about $50,000 for each man, woman, and child in the United States.
It is a lot of money. A family of four is on the hook for a couple hundred thousand dollars. You know, it's
yeah, you know, and the thing is, see, look, I hate to say it, and you know, maybe some people in your audience are gonna scoff at what I have to say, but the fact of the matter is, the reason the United States is in the current fiscal situation that it's in is not because of some Wall Street fat cats. It's not because of, you know, some big conspiracy. It's because the American people allowed this situation to happen. I mean, it's all good and fine and saying that, you know, oh, I weigh 500 pounds because of genes. But the fact of the matter is, if you keep stuffing your face, inevitably you're going to reach 500 pounds. I mean, it's a fact of life. And I know this isn't popular to say it, and I know a lot of people are going to be offended by it, but it's the truth. You have to look the truth in the face. It's not a big conspiracy. It's not Wall Street. It's basically politicians promising people something for nothing, and that people, that is Americans, believing them, you know? I mean, you know, you have Ronald Reagan who said, you know, government is the problem, okay? Which is fine. Then he implemented a tax cut. But did he cut, you know, other things, entitlements, defense, what have you? No, he did not, you know? And, you know, George Bush and Bill Clinton, George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton, for various reasons, were able to do that to some extent of, you know, cutting spending and taxes and trying to make smaller the U.S. federal government. But then you had this incompetent buffoon of, you know, George W. Bush and his megalomaniacal crazed cabal of people. And I say this as a conservative Catholic, okay? I mean, I'm not some hippie, you know, smoking dope with long hair and all that. You know, I shave every morning and after lunch. Okay, I just want to be very clear about that. But, you know, you had a group of people who were just who betrayed everything that the United States stands for, basically. Because if you look at the whole regime of tortures, of illegal wiretappings and all the rest of it, a lot of people are saying that, you know, Obama's administration is very bad in terms of civil liberties. Well, the issue becomes, if it's allowed for George W. Bush, then why shouldn't Obama just continue it? I mean, that's what he's done. You know, you have a complete political class that is completely that has betrayed everything that the United States stands for. And I've noticed something, that people outside of the United States feel a lot more sorrow than people in the United States for what has been lost, you know, in America. Because it seems to me, and this is my opinion, but I think a lot of people share this, it seems that everything good and noble and true and decent about the United States has been thrown out the window, you know, and the greatness of the United States has been betrayed in such a craven and awful way. I mean, it's indescribable. I mean, everything that was good about the United States, you know, the sense of self-reliance, the respect for hard work, the respect for education. You know, people in the United States, I mean, the young people in the United States, they're completely ignorant about not only the world, but, you know, the most basic history, the most basic things that, you know, a civilized people ought to know in order to go out into the world and deal with the world. And so, you know, a lot of Americans are saying, oh, why do they hate us in Iraq? Or the Middle East or Europe or wherever. Well, you know, if you act like a bully and a buffoon, then of course people are going to despise you. You know, it's inevitable. You know, I mean, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said something really, really true in the Gulag Archipelago. He said the following. He said, If we feel we are not sufficiently respected, we should ask ourselves if we are living as we should. I mean, that's a profound statement, and it's very true. If people around you think that you're doing wrong, and everybody thinks that you're doing wrong, and every metric that you can use to measure success or failure points to failure, you know, every objective standard, you know, budget deficits, you know, balance of trade, every metric in every category is negative, then you have to ask yourself two things. Either the rest of the world is in this huge grand conspiracy to screw us over, or we are acting in a way that we should not, you know. And it seems to me that most people, especially a lot of expats such as myself who have lived outside the United States for a while now, it breaks our heart because, you know, we see how far the United States has fallen, and we see, in my own case at least, the people who don't seem particularly willing to solve their problems. They seem more willing to just, you know, let them slide and just sort of like sink into a morass of not merely despair, but of apathy. And it just breaks my heart. I'm sorry if I'm ranting, you know, but it's really something that strikes my heart very closely, because I have enormous affection for the United States, but I have enormous respect as a historian for what the United States represents, the brilliance that it represents. And it seems so sad that that is all fading, you know, so quickly, right before our eyes.
Well, Gonzalo, in our final moments, why don't you give us some idea of, just based upon your own analysis, history on your own analysis of the economy here in the United States. Obviously, a train wreck. Obviously, $14 trillion in the hole. No sign of turning back. No sign of turning around. No sign of even the most basic cognizance of the fact that something's wrong in Washington. So, given that, but also given the fact that miracles can happen, how confident are you that this is going to end in hyperinflation as opposed to some other route?
What other route? I mean, that's a fair question. I mean, I don't mean to be flip, but, you know, what other route would there be? Deflation? I mean, not really going to happen. It seems to me inevitable, because it seems to me that all of the participants in this particular dance, they have their eyes set on the same thing, just stimulate. It's like, you know, they're trying to goose an engine that's about to just, you know, blow up. It's over. I'm not trying to be flip or anything, but I don't see any other explanation or any other outcome except a currency collapse. I don't see how the United States economy is going to grow. I just don't see it, you know, and I'd love to be wrong. I mean, that would be wonderful, to tell you the truth. I mean, who wouldn't prefer, you know, a recovery as opposed to a hyperinflationary collapse? I mean, you know, I'm a lot of things, but I'm not a cruel guy. You know, I'm not evil. I'm not like, you know, sitting around there in my Dr. Evil outfit saying, "Ooh, I hope that the end of the world happens." Quite the contrary. But I, honest to goodness, do not see how this fate will be avoided. I mean, do you?
No, I certainly don't. I'm just curious. You know, we've actually had people like Robert Prechter on who have, over time, you know, my thesis and our basic stance in our book and everything that we've talked about is basically that hyperinflation is the way because of the basic economic laws can't be violated. But, you know, nevertheless, there still are the Robert Prechters of the world and those who actually believe that deflation is where we're heading from here.
We were in deflation. Okay. That's an accurate assessment. Okay. Once the collapse of the shadow banking system happened in 2007 and 2008, culminating rather spectacularly with the implosion of Lehman Brothers. Yeah, starting with Lehman Brothers, we had severe deflation. Deflation being, you know, characterized as a loss of credit or money, you know, forcing prices down. You know, that is an accurate assessment. And to tell you the truth, on careful consideration, I understand, though do not necessarily agree with, Ben Bernanke's actions of September of 08 when he implemented quantitative easing and expanded the Fed balance sheet from, I think it was $873 billion to eventually in 90 days time, $2.4 trillion by basically going out there and buying all these mortgage-backed securities. I understand that rationale, and I am not sure if I would have done something different, to tell you the truth, but be that as it may, the point is, I think it's Stoneley who's written about this, that the collapse in credit was something on the order of about $2 trillion or so of loss of credit once the shadow banking system collapsed. And, you know, you have that $2 trillion figure, and so that kind of a contraction of the credit, which is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, money and credit, same thing. Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, you're talking about a severe deflation. But what happened afterwards, especially as of March of 2009, when FASB 157, the accounting rule, was suspended, and so banks rather no longer had to mark to market their assets, and they could basically mark to make believe, so that a particular, you know, mortgage-backed security or other troubled asset could be marked on their accounting books as having whatever value the banks deemed it had, and thereby avoid insolvency or technical insolvency. You know, between September of 08 and March of 09, there was deflation, no question. But between QE1 and the suspension of the FASB rule, I think that's when it ended, and that's when we turned the corner. I think retrospectively, historians are going to realize that, you know, it was sort of like a collapse in credit brought about by the collapse of the shadow banking industry, and the Fed and the Treasury overstimulating and overshooting the mark, and then continuing as the economy failed to improve, because I think that the principal problem was that neither the Treasury Department nor the Federal Reserve did what had to be done, which was to liquidate the too big to fail banks, not just save them, but liquidate them, liquidate the bondholders in those banks, and start over, which is exactly what Sweden did back in 92, and which is exactly what Chile did back in 82 also, or 81, 82, and which every severe financial crisis, every country that has had a severe financial crisis and has turned the corner has done, which is, you know, cut the gangrene quickly so that the organism will spring back to life and regain its health and continue on. And the authorities, Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson and then Timothy Geithner as secretaries of the Treasury, failed to do this, which was to wipe out the too big to fail banks. Instead of wiping them out, they kept on funding them and making them bigger. And now you have these, you know, huge banks that are sucking dry the entire financial industry, and there are a stone necklace around the American economy, but yeah, so there was deflation initially. This is a very long-winded, you know, explanation as to why there was deflation initially, you know, in between, as I said, September of 08 and March of 09. But since March of 09, between the first quantitative easing, then the stimulus, then quantitative easing light, you know, announced last summer, and now QE2, which is supposed to last through June of next year, they've overshot the mark. And the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet and the amount of stimulus, if you add it all together, it's pretty much twice what was lost when the shadow banking industry collapsed. And I think that, you know, this overshooting of the mark is what we're going to be paying for. And it's, you know, the kindling for the fire of hyperinflation. And we see that because as the Federal Reserve Board tries to prop up asset prices, both bonds, equities, and even real estate to an extent, you know, he's trying to prop them up. But all he's really doing is, you know, adding fuel to the fire in terms of commodity prices, which are reaching the consumers and which are, you know, biting at their heels and which are going to make prices go very ugly during 2011. And that's when we're going to start seeing hyperinflation, as I've outlined before.
Well, Gonzalo, I really appreciate your analysis and time. I got to have you back on. We'll do an update on hyperinflation maybe in later in the year, and then also we'll have you back on to talk about the euro, as that is certainly a story that needs to be treated.
Oh, yeah. That's happening now. If you want to get the story on the euro, you better hurry, because that is in the mail. That story is going to happen soon. I mean, soon, I'm talking like next 6 weeks. That's going to happen. It's going to get ugly. So, yeah, I'd love to be on your show whenever you want.
In these final moments, if you would, if our audience would like to learn more about you, how they can find out about your articles and whatnot, what's the best way for them to find out about you and your work?
Now, the easiest way is just to Google me. I am Gonzalo Lira, G-O-N-Z-A-L-O, last name Lira, L-I-R-A. Just Google me and I'm sure that you'll find my blog site, which is gonzalolira.blogspot.com. And I run a daily blog site called The Hourly G, which just started. And The Hourly G is, you know, it's finance and economics, but it's fun. And I think that you'll enjoy it. And, yeah, please do stop by at either site.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.